Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. We're back on the economy today with Jack Rasmus. You all know Jack, and let me mention his book. And before we begin, I want to say something that's very important to me on another topic. I was hoping to do it on my Thursday program, but the news had not broken as yet, so I wasn't able to do it. I was on alert all day, and I'll explain why in a moment. I think a lot of listeners know it, but I'll explain it briefly again because it's another important issue for me. But Jack, of course, is an economist. He teaches out in California. He does so much. He's a freelance journalist, frequent speaker. He's a playwright. He's written a number of books, and they're all important ones. His newest one is called Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. I think a lot of listeners know that the recession, call it what you will, was declared over the middle of last year. Well, tell that to the millions who are unemployed, et cetera, and so on. We'll get into that in a moment. But let me just say a few words about a topic that I write about all the time, the topic of political prisoners, and one in particular who was sentenced on Thursday. Her name is Afia Siddiqui. I wrote about her three times before. She may be the most horrific case I have written about. I've written on about 40 political prisoners in this country. America has hundreds of political prisoners. You never hear a word about it on the major media. And by the broadest definition, we have thousands of political prisoners. In that category, I include, goodness, I haven't taken a count lately, but the count is horrendous. It's so great. The numbers of Latinos, undocumented Latinos, who come here not because they want to, but because destructive trade laws like NAFTA destroy their livelihoods back home. And if they want to feed their families, they have to do something. Most of them are farmers. Agribusiness gets great subsidies. Jack knows all about that. Their livelihoods have been destroyed, so they have to do something, and they come here. Great numbers of them, out of desperation. We call them criminals. The real criminals are the people who enact these trade laws. But Afia's case is really horrendous. Lots of political prisoners are treated very harshly. I don't know of anyone treated more harshly than Afia since she was arrested, abducted in March of 2003. Brutally tortured, repeatedly raped at Bagram prison in Afghanistan by U.S. authorities. And then she was transferred to New York. Her persona was completely destroyed. She's not the same person she was before. She's a Pakistani scientist, but again, she's not the same person. She was convicted in February, and on Thursday she was sentenced to 86 years in prison for doing what? Not what she was initially accused of. The initial rage against her was she had bomb-making instructions and she was planning to blow up New York landmarks. How many times have we heard that one before? Those charges never appeared in her indictment, which shows how bogus they were. And they vilified her with horrible names, calling her Al-Qaeda lady and other vilifications. They want to beat up on somebody, they can easily do it. And the major media goes along all the time. Forget the facts, forget the evidence. Just repeat government lies over and over and over again. So what was she convicted of and given 86 years? She's frail. She went through years of torture. She weighs 110 pounds, and she was going through another interrogation at the Bagram prison in the presence of two FBI agents, two Army interpreters, and three U.S. Army officers. I guess that's seven people in total. She was accused of assaulting three of them, grabbing one of their rifles. Now imagine this, trained officers, FBI agents. She managed to get one of their rifles, open fire, they said, at close range, at point-blank range, you know, in the same room together, interrogation. Hit nobody, and yet she was the only one severely wounded. The charges were completely bogus anyway. I wrote about her again on Thursday. I had to mention this because I will not forget Afia. And this morning I scheduled her lawyer for the second time to come on my program later in October. And we'll talk about the case again, and I'm thinking of writing another article. Jack, forgive me for that other issue to start off the program. This is very important because too few people know how we frame innocent people. We torture innocent people. We brutalize, besides the illegal wars and all the rest and so on. And I have another article on Iraq coming out tomorrow. It is powerful with all the stuff I put in it. I just go with the facts, Jack, and let them speak for themselves. But the facts on the economy speak for themselves, too. So let's jump over to that topic. Jack, I welcome you to the program again.
Thank you.
Thank you for the indulgence of letting me explain what I hoped to do Thursday, but I didn't have a chance. Let's get back on the economy again. And recession over? I think you might have another view on that.
Well, let's first define what we mean by recovery. Okay, GDP is often used as the indicator, gross domestic product, right? And it appears that the gross domestic product is no longer falling for several quarters. However, the growth rate of that GDP is falling. In other words, while we had some recovery here late last year in gross domestic product, that recovery percent terms every quarter is getting less and less. Last quarter is 1.6%. This current quarter, I'm sure it will be 1% or less. And my prediction is by 2011, first or second quarter, it will be flat. You know, what is a recovery? Is it simply not collapsing, or is it not getting back what you lost? Well, we're not falling through the floor, but we're not recovering anything either. We are stagnant, and the stagnation is slowing down once again, and we're approaching a period where there's very little growth rate of any kind going on. Now, you can also look at indicators other than GDP and, you know, look at jobs. Well, unemployment is rising. That's not an improvement. Foreclosures are at record highs, and both in the rate of foreclosures as well, home foreclosures, as well as the amount of foreclosures. We got 7 million going to 10 million, which is about one-fourth almost, sort of one-fifth of all the homes with mortgages are going under. And that's not counting maybe another 2 or 3 million more where the banks just aren't processing the foreclosures. So it's even the foreclosures, as horrendous as they are actually much worse than they are. Home prices are beginning to fall again after this lifting of this temporary program by the Obama administration last spring, which was called first-time home buyers, if you remember. And all that did was bring future home sales into the present. So now with it eliminated, we're seeing a collapse once again in the housing market. A commercial property market has been flat, stagnant for a long time. The question is, can you get any kind of sustained recovery with 20, 25 million, about 25 million people effectively unemployed today, and 10 million homes in foreclosure? And that's not counting the maybe another 10 million or so that are underwater. In other words, people aren't being foreclosed, but their homes are worth less than they owe. those two conditions cannot get you a quote, true recovery. If recovery means a returning back to where you were, I mean, that's what recovery should mean. Simply because you're not collapsing through the floor anymore and you're stagnating, that doesn't mean recovery. But, you know, so it's not too surprising that the NBER, National Bureau of Economic Research economists, have come out with, and there were a lot of disputes within that group whether they should declare. It was not unanimous. Some of them felt that there's no way you could say this thing is over, and some of them did. You know, no doubt arm-twisted by the administration right before the election to say that, quote, the recession is over.
Jack, let me throw in one comment. These are mainstream economists. There are no Jack Rasmuses on the NBER.
No, they're all Harvard, Princeton, a couple from Stanford, Cal. You know, these are all
the usual suspects,
the big name gurus that get to write the op-ed pieces, you know.
Indeed, and show up on CNBC and the rest of it.
Yes, yes. I mean, if you look at a whole host of indicators, let's take business spending and consumption. You know, consumption is 70% of the economy. It's flat. Business spending is at only 7% of GDP. Typically, it's about 13%. It's at its lowest rate in decades here. And last year, it was actually negative. So this year, you know, what little minor increases occurred is not really all that significant, and it is beginning to turn down once again. And, of course, we know government is not spending anymore. State and local government is continuing to cut back. So if business spending has flattened out after a brief upturn and is turning down here in 2010, and if you've got consumption stagnant and government's going to cut back, well, no wonder that GDP is slowing down, and I predict will continue to slow down. And all the indications are to that effect in the U.S. Now, look at what's happening at the same time in Europe and Japan. A lot of hype a couple of months ago, as in the U.S., that, oh, Europe is recovering and Germany's leading the way. Well, that was just for a couple months. And now everything is turning down again in Europe. The Purchasing Managers Index has lost several points in Europe. It's at a seven-month low. Manufacturing is slowing in Europe as U.S. and Asian economies slow. You've got Euro banks in trouble again, particularly led by Ireland. You've got austerity being imposed, which is not only means the government is not spending, but when you start cutting government spending, it has an impact on consumer spending as well. So beware of that when, after the Republican sweep in November, I predict, and they start cutting spending, it's only going to exacerbate the already strong trends of turning down. You got to be aware of what goes on in the business press because they hype the very short term changes month to month. But you got to look longer term. You got to look 3, 6, 12 month trends to really see what's going on because it goes up and down. Japan slowing down as well. Their GDP falling to zero. They have once again a big problem with deflation, falling prices, negative prices, which are really very, very dangerous. That ends up with, if you've got deflation, consumers stop buying even more, anticipating further lower prices. Business stop investing even more, anticipating less revenues because they can't get price increases. So deflation is extremely dangerous. Japanese companies, instead of investing in Japan, are investing offshore more. In the U.S., deflation is beginning to approach. We've got consumer prices now less than 1%, and they're probably flat because we tend to overestimate them for various reasons I won't get into. So we're approaching deflation, and that's why you see the Federal Reserve and Ben Bernanke talking about, oh, we may have to pump more money into the economy because they're worried about deflation beginning to occur.
But this is what Japan tried for two decades, as you know, Jack. And isn't Japan a good example of what we may face for a good many years ahead? Japan peaked at the end of 1999 And then that was the stock market at almost 39,000. The last I checked, it was about 9,500, but it dropped to about 7,000 a year or so ago. We're talking 20 years later. Japan dropped their interest rates to zero, just about zero, and they pumped all kinds of money out. And this has been going on for 20 years with no results check. So if the Fed, you know, we had QE1, and now apparently we have QE2 ongoing, what the devil good is it going to do if the model is Japan tried it and it didn't work?
Well, actually, Japan's crash occurred in 91, 92, even earlier than you mentioned.
Oh, at the end of 89.
Japan is a good example of what I call an epic recession. Epic recession is when the banks get bailed out at the taxpayer expense, but the economy is not sufficiently stimulated in terms of government spending on jobs and housing and so forth. And the result of that is a prevention of a further collapse, but you get a long-run, decade-long stagnation as a consequence of that. That's what I call a type one epic recession. Bail out the banks. Don't stimulate jobs and housing in the economy, and you get a long, years-long stagnation. A type two is when you fail to even bail out the banks, and then you get a depression. In other words, you get a series of banking crises that occur in sequence. And we're on the verge of another such, you know, in Europe. It's maturing. It's developing over there. May also happen in Japan. So, yes, we are very similar to what happened in Japan right now. The lesson is, as you indicate, you cannot generate a sustained recovery simply by monetary policy, by low interest rates, zero interest rates, or even what you call QE, quantitative easing, which is a fancy word for just pumping money into, printing money, pumping it into the economy and buying bad bonds by the Federal Reserve. You see, the Fed, unlike Congress, does not have to get permission for funding. Congress, you know, if you were going to pass the TARP bill, a bailout bill, Congress had to appropriate money. Well, Fed doesn't have to do that. It just prints the money. And that's what really has been the core of the strategy here by the Obama administration. And in the very beginning, it was clear in early 2009, that whole Obama strategy was let's bail out the banks, whatever it takes to bail out the banks, and it's been trillions, and let's put a floor under consumption by giving money to the unemployed and to states and to, you know, some to Social Security recipients and so forth for a short term. Because we believe that if we do that, Obama said, it'll get credit flowing again. That was the key. You know, let the markets generate the recovery. Unlike during the Depression, where the government generated the recovery.
Sounds like Herbert Hoover to me, Jack.
Yeah, well, there's lots of similarities there. You know, over-reliance on the market system, and the market system is what blew up. You know, so you're trying to use that tool that broke for the recovery. And, you know, what did we get? Well, we rescued the banks. They're not totally rescued, but we bought time with them. The Big 18 are rescued, by the way, except for Citigroup and a couple others. They're effectively bankrupt. AIG, they're just selling off their assets at fire sale prices, and they will shrink even further. But, you know, the small banks, they're going under little by little. That's why the government tried to pump $30 billion into the situation. But, the thing to remember is that the banks have been... The big banks have been rescued, and they're sitting on a hoard of trillion-dollar cash, but they aren't loaning it to small businesses and medium businesses in the United States. The big guys, the big corporations, multinationals, they don't need bank loans. What they do is issue bonds and commercial paper. They don't borrow from the banks. And the big businesses are also fat with cash. They got $1.84 trillion in cash. The banks have $1 trillion in cash and aren't loaning it. The multinationals, mid and large-sized companies, have almost $2 trillion in cash, and they aren't investing it. And all this talk about, well, we got to give them more tax cuts so they have more cash to invest. Well, they're sitting on a mountain of cash and they're not investing. What good is tax cuts? giving them more cash going to do if they're sitting on a mountain of now and they're not investing in jobs in the U.S.?
It's just incredible.
All this arguing about business tax cuts. Now, you may have noticed the connection here with the stock market this past month, which has risen significantly, okay? And they're saying, oh, well, this is a long-term trend, meaning the recovery is over. What this is that the big corporations sitting on all this money, because they're not investing it in jobs, what are they doing with it? They're buying back their stock. They've spent $300 billion of that $1.84 trillion to buy back their stock, which drives up the stock prices and which, of course, means you've got a rising stock market for a very short period. Why are they doing this? Because there is some concern after the election that they're going to have to at least do something about some of the business investor tax cuts that Bush, $3.4 trillion, that's supposed to sunset here at the end of the year. There's some concern that there may be some revisions to that because the U.S. debt's so bad. So they're quickly spending it, giving it to their big investors, big stock investors, and buying back the stocks, which is better than just giving dividends. Because if you buy back your stock, it drives up the valuation of your company, and if I'm a CEO, I'm going to get a big bonus as a result. I don't get a bonus from increasing dividends, but I get a big bonus from buying back the stock.
Jack, let me just explain that a little bit. When they buy back stock, there is less of it outstanding. Less of it outstanding means the price will rise.
That's right.
If they did the opposite, there would be more stock floated, and the price would drop. Can I ask you a couple of questions?
Sure.
2 points, and you can take them. Say, take them in this order. A request. Explain the difference between government policy today and what FDR did in the 1930s. He helped the big banks out, but he did a lot more. And then my second point is, about a week or so ago, we had Basel III raising reserve requirements but not doing it, the final requirement to 2019. But explain the difference between now and the policy in the 1930s and the significance of Basel III.
Okay. All right. In the 1930s, when FDR came into office, interestingly, FDR introduced for the first 2 years, 33-34, a policy not too dissimilar to what Obama has introduced. In other words, the whole focus was on bailing out the banks. 1933, all the bank acts and financial acts and so forth. There was a minor a job creation bill called the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, where they took very young men off the street, several 300,000 of them, and sent them into the woods. Get them off the street. That was also a political move as well, so they're not demonstrating and so forth, because young men tend to be a little bit more aggressive. But the CCC, improved a little bit the job situation, but not much. But the big emphasis was on the banks. As soon as they bailed out the banks, the stock market and some other business indicators shot right up in 33. But it lasted about 9 months, and then it faded. By 34, things were flat once again, kind of like they are now. Coming up to the 34 elections, FDR realized that he wasn't creating enough jobs. So what was launched was the New Deal. The New Deal began 2 years after, not until 35, after the November 34 elections, do we start getting the New Deal. And what the New Deal was, the government was going to create jobs directly, the Works Progress Administration. And in the course of the first 18 months, hired more than 3 million jobs. The government provided jobs to people. Now, 3 million is on top of a workforce of only 40 million, so that's like almost 10 million jobs today. Within the course of 18 months, the government created 10 million jobs. over 8 million jobs, almost one-fourth of the total workforce, was created over the history of the Works Progress Administration. Why? Because businesses weren't hiring. Banks were recovering, but they weren't lending, just as they're not lending now. Bank lending has fallen for the last 15 months. So what do we got with Obama? What we've got is a situation where, once again, bail out the banks. We're not going to really directly create jobs. And now he's stuck. The difference between Obama and FDR, apart from attitude, I mean, FDR was not afraid to take on business. You know, he said, I welcome their criticism. You know, but Obama now is looks like he's going to appoint some business people to positions because he's, you know, he's a Democrat. He's a modern Democrat, and they're afraid of business, really. So what we've got is a situation where Obama needs to do what FDR did but won't do it, which means we're not going to get a recovery next year like we did with FDR in 35 to 37. Okay, that's the difference. Obama has been relying on the market, relying on his advisors to tell him, we got to save the banks first, we got to save GM first, and so forth. Well, what about the 25 million workers out there, and what about the 10 million homeowners out there? They're not getting saved at all, and that's the key to consumption. The key to the recovery is jobs and housing. But he hasn't paid enough attention to it, and now he's going to lose whatever votes he has. There'll be a massive sweep of Democrats out of office in November, and Republicans are going to come back in with their same old worn-out policies of cut taxes and cut spending, and they are going to make it worse, no doubt about it. And that is what I predict in epic recession, that you have a series of very weak recoveries followed by short weak recoveries followed by relapses that tend to be short and weak, and then they throw a little bit more money in, and they stop it from falling again, but they don't put enough money into it to generate a true recovery. So you get another weak and short recovery. That, by the way, is exactly what happened in 1907-14. We had the biggest financial crash in our history in 1907, bailed out the banks, didn't stimulate the economy, and we had 7 years of stagnation until World War I came, and of course the government then spent money. In 1929, we had the start of an epic recession at the beginning of the Depression, but we didn't bail out the banks. We had a series of four banking crises in a row, and that just drove the economy down into a depression. So we will see whether we're going to stagnate up and down like Japan for the next 5-6 years, or whether we're going to maybe slip into another global depression if the banking system in Europe goes bust. Either one of those seem to be on the horizon. Neither guaranteed, but that's the choice. Sustained recovery does not seem to be on the horizon.
I think I hear the background music, Jack. Let's take a break, and I think, as you explain, I think it looks pretty grim, and it's astonishing from all we know about what has been done in the past in this country and abroad. We sure know what works, and we sure know what doesn't work, and yet we seem to continue to repeat too much of the things that don't work. And maybe your term, epic recession, really describes it best. Let's take a break and come back and explain
Let's talk about China and Japan when we come back.
Oh, China and Japan. First talk about Basel III.
Okay.
And explain that and what it means. And I see that as another up to no good. Help for the big banks. And the small ones can, we want to get rid of them anyway, so maybe that's what it's all about. But I'll let you explain it. Let's take a break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world. Every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
On with Jack Rasmus, talking about the economy. Jack, quickly go into a little bit of an explanation on Basel III. I suspect a lot of listeners are not familiar with it, but we're talking about the central bank of central bankers Basel, Switzerland. Explain what they did on Basel III and what it means.
Okay, we have regular banks and we have shadow banks. And then we have central banks like the Federal Reserve Bank of England, European Central Bank, and then we have the central bankers get together in Basel, Bank of International Settlements, and so forth. Basel, Switzerland, it's named after a town, and they sort of try to coordinate central bank policies. And one of the things that's been very clear about this whole crisis is that banks have over-leveraged themselves. I'm talking about commercial banks now and shadow banks, not central banks. Over-leveraging means that they borrow a lot of money and loan it out and don't have enough reserves of their own on hand if there's a crisis. That's called leveraging. In other words, borrowing money and loaning it rather than using your own money. But when things collapse, you don't have enough money to pay off all the debt you borrowed. It's an example of banks overextending on debt, just like companies overextend on debt, and just like households and governments overextend on debt from time to time. And one of our big problems, of course, is that it's been a debt-run economy. Most of the debt, by the way, has been business bank debt, overwhelmingly. Typically, the press tries to explain it as the profligate consumer, buying too much. Well, that's a small part of the total debt, which is over, in the U.S., when you look at government household and business debt, over $50 trillion. We've accumulated, doubled it almost in 10 years. Most of that's business debt and leveraging. Well, the whole Basel thing is to get banks not to leverage as much and to keep more capital in their reserves. So if there is another crisis, which they anticipate, then they'll have more money to be able to handle the crisis. Now, The banks, the commercial banks, shadow banks, and so forth, have been lobbying hard and resisting both financial regulation bills, like we just had passed in the U.S., which was a joke. Financial regulation governments are trying to institute in Europe, and of course, they're trying to coordinate it globally as well. And that's what Basel III is. But it's a mouse that didn't roar. Basel III came out with such weak proposals on reducing leverage by the banks and keeping reserves on hand that immediately the business press just lauded the very weak proposals that came out of Basel II. And how did the banks themselves prevent it? Well, just like they helped watered down the bill that was passed at the national level in the U.S. They've watered down the Basel Committee's proposals by claiming that if you put limitations on us, Basel, of how much we can borrow and loan and how much reserves we have to keep, then that's going to prevent us from lending. Well, they're already not lending before they even passed the Basel bill, right? I mean, the Basel proposals. But they claim that if you raise requirements on us, it will mean that 3% collapse, a total loss or decline, reduction of 3% in gross domestic product, and 10 million more jobs will be lost. Well, that's what business always says. You know, I mean, you tax us, you put any regulations on us, we're just not going to invest or create jobs. And they have their hands on the throat of job creation, of course, in this kind of a system. But economists, by the way, at Harvard and elsewhere, said that the impact on GDP and jobs is about one-fifth of what the banks are all claiming would happen if you pass stringent recommendations on how much capital banks, in other words, cash, banks must hold in reserves. And that's the story in a nutshell. It's a mouse that roared or didn't even roar, very similar to the very, very weak legislation passed by the U.S. here, the financial regulation bill that the Obama administration is making a big deal about, but it's a big joke. The day after the U.S. financial regulation bill passed, bank stocks boomed because they knew it was not any kind of a restriction, and bankers and business pundits said, oh, this was acting, the U.S. government was acting very responsibly by not putting too much limitations on banks.
Jack, Wall Street lawyers wrote financial reform to be sure that the banks and the big insurers and the other big financial interests got exactly what they wanted, if not everything, enough that mattered. So, I mean, the market should have gone up days in advance because they knew what this bill was. But, you know, they play that game. Here's the point that I wanted to get at. I'm sure that what the International Bank in Basel did, and what the Fed and ECB and the others who were there and agreed on all this, Bernanke and these other characters that meet and decide these rules, what they want to do is to help the big bankers, and my feeling is that what they're doing is harming the little guys, or harming the big guys at the expense of the little guys, to get rid of as many of the little guys as possible to facilitate greater global consolidation. Isn't that what this scheme really is all about?
Well, we really have three, maybe four banking systems in the United States. We have the big 18, 19 banks, okay? And they have over two-thirds of all the assets to loan. And then we have we had about 8,000 very small banks. We've lost a couple hundred of those, and there's more that are going to go under. The small regional banks are involved largely in real estate, commercial real estate, and small business loans and housing and so forth. And that market, commercial real estate, has totally collapsed, and the smaller banks, about 7,800 of them now, are slowly going under or not reviving. That's why the government passed this $30 billion small business bill, which is really a small bank subsidization bill. Keep that in mind, right? It's all designed to get pump $30 billion into the small banks so they'll loan to small business because big banks, as I said before, are not loaning to small business in the United States. Well, why do we even have to go through the banks? Why doesn't the government just loan directly to small business, right? Bypass the banks. You don't really need them. Why do they have to skim the cream off the top before they give it to businesses that do create jobs, right? You know, expand the Small Business Loan Association. Come up with a new structure, which is what I've proposed in my book, that says, look, we should directly loan to small and medium business and consumers, you know, mortgage markets, consumer credit markets, small business and loan markets. The government should loan directly to these businesses and take it out of the hands of the speculators, the big banks that are speculators, and who, when they get in trouble, they drag the rest of the economy down. We should create a utility banking system, direct loans from the government to those parts of the economy that are so essential to job creation, and take it out of the hands of the big banks and the big speculators.
Oh, a big amen for me on that.
Yeah. The point is that the small banks are a separate, small regional banks are a separate banking system. And then you have what's called the shadow banking system in the U.S., and these are private equity companies, hedge funds, finance companies, so on and so forth. And they are as big as the big banks, and they are integrated with the big banks. And these are the big speculators. These are the fellows who, buy and sell global properties and commodities and currencies and so forth. And the big banks, being integrated with them, feed them big amounts of consumers' money to speculate abroad, which doesn't create any jobs in the U.S., you see.
And they definitely work together. The big hedge funds,
right,
and the big
right.
Wall Street firms, Goldman, Chase.
Oh, yeah,
they are very closely linked,
yep.
And they're working together on the same schemes. But even the big Wall Street banks, Jack, they leverage, who knows to what extent, 30, 130 times. I mean, they're buying all of these derivatives and playing these casino games instead of, as you say, lending. Well, they're not in the lending business now. They're in the casino business now.
Yeah, it's much more profitable to speculate in Brazilian currencies than it is to loan mom and pop business to hire some people to grow jobs. That's part of the problem with the nature of the global economy at the present. We have maybe $10 to $20 trillion of the speculative liquidity of money that's floating around the world, sloshing around from bubble to bubble. This is what I call the global money parade. This whole network of shadow and commercial banking institutions, wealthy investors keeping trillions of dollars in their offshore tax havens in the Cayman Islands and everywhere else. They're playing all these games, taking money out of the U.S. So they don't have to keep it in the U.S. and pay taxes on it. And they're getting huge returns. Of course, when times collapse, the returns aren't as great, but they sit tight. You know, they hoard their money, and they wait for the good opportunities again. And that's why we're not getting job creation and not getting real investment in real businesses. You know, now the big business multinationals, they don't have to worry about borrowing from banks. As I said, they just issue junk bonds, and if they're not in that good a shape, or they issue investment grade bonds and commercial paper, and they also have been squeezing their workforces and generating profits, record profits, of course, by squeezing, reducing costs, laying people off, getting people to work harder who still have jobs, and by raising cash in the bond markets. And they're sitting on this big cash hoard, and they won't spend it because they're waiting for the more profitable speculative opportunities. And this brings us to the fourth banking, quote, bank system, if you would, financial system, and that's the large multinational corporations, who are also huge investors in derivatives. See, it's not just the shadow banks, private equity, hedge funds. It's not just the commercial banks, J.P. Morgan, Chase, and Wells Fargo. There's this fourth banking system, The third being the small banks, regional banks, fourth banking system, where big companies speculate themselves more and more, become financial institutions in these global derivatives. That's why with the financial reform bill just passed, the derivatives weren't touched for these non-financial corporations. For the hedge funds and other big banks, what is being, quote, regulated in the financial regulation bill is official over-the-counter swaps. Well, most of the derivatives aren't over-the-counter. They're customized. You don't know where they are and who's making all these deals. And then, you know, even the banks can get around that by setting up these derivative trading desks offshore from the U.S., you see. So it's full of holes. And the problems of speculation that led to this financial bust are still very much with us and will raise their ugly head once again down the road.
That's
because
exactly
they haven't
it,
stopped it.
One bubble leads to another bubble, leads to another bubble. They all seem to get bigger. And let me throw another couple of things at you because the hour will disappear but before
and
we realize
it. Let's talk about
it,
China and Japan. What's
well,
going on
you,
over
you,
there?
You want to talk about China and Japan. And one quickie comment on, I'm willing to bet dollars to donuts that after all of the pre-election, November election rhetoric, the Democrats will be very willing to extend the tax cuts to the rich, even though they're wailing and complaining about them now. After November 2nd, they will extend the tax cuts to the rich, in a package where everybody, they simply won't touch the Bush tax cuts. Any disagreement with that?
A minor disagreement, okay? I believe that there will be some rollback of the Bush tax cuts for the very wealthy and very, high-level investors and corporations, some token rollback, because they are going to have to really focus on raising taxes for the middle class. And they can't do it in a way that looks like they're just attacking the middle class. They got to throw in a few provisions there that they're going to roll back, for the wealthy. But it will be tokenism.
Jack,
it will be tokenism, and most of it will be attacking the middle class. The alternate minimum tax will be raised, which is really attacking the middle class, and other provisions and cutbacks. And, of course, cutbacks, attempts to cut back on Social Security and Medicare and so forth. It'll be a big package.
For sure that, but are you saying a tax increase in the lame duck Congress?
No, there won't be anything in this Congress. I mean, the Democrats have said they're going to wait until after the election.
Well, that's what I mean, in the lame duck session before the new Congress comes in January.
Oh, I don't think they're going to be able to agree on anything that quickly, no.
Oh, I'm surprised.
No.
I suspect that they will. Well, let's see what happens.
It's always
dangerous predicting what Congress may or may not do, unless you're on the inside and you really know, and I certainly am not. But my guess is in the lame duck session, they will extend the Bush tax cuts. We'll see. And then there'll be a new Congress. Republicans very likely will take the House, may not take the Senate. Oh, wouldn't that be interesting if they took the House and the Senate, Jack?
I think there's a good chance they will.
Yes. We really will be back to Herbert Hoover again.
Oh, yes. Well, that's what I said a minute ago. I think it will accelerate the failure not to spend on job creation. That will get even worse. Okay, and government will reduce its spending, fiscal spending. Let's take this whole question of the tax cuts, Bush tax cuts. $3.4 trillion in the Bush administration tax cuts, 80% went to the wealthiest 20%, most of that to the wealthiest 5% of investors. And what did we get? We got the weakest job creation. It took 4 years to recover jobs lost from that very weak 2001 recession. 4 years. In other words, where did that money go, the tax cuts? It went offshore. Began part of the global money parade, went into derivatives and so forth. Then we get the Bush tax cut bill of 2008 as the crisis began to deepen. $90 billion of $168 billion went to business tax cuts. Did we get in recovery? No, things got much worse. Then we got the Obama recovery bill of 2009, $225 billion of which was business tax cuts. Did we get in recovery? No. Business tax cuts are nonsense. when you are in a situation where you have stagnation or decline. Why? Because, look, let's take a typical businessman, Joe the Flower Man, let's call him. Joe delivers flowers. He's got a flower delivery service, right? You give him tax cuts. Is he going to hire more workers, buy more trucks, and go and sell more flowers when people aren't buying flowers? No, Joe's not stupid. He's been in business a long time. He'd like to use the tax cuts to expand, but he'll just take them and put them in his pocket. He won't expand. You know, one of the biggest lies that have been pushed on people, and people believe it ever since Reagan, is that business tax cuts create jobs. Nonsense. They don't, especially when you are in the decline of a business cycle and the situation we are in. They do not create jobs. And
Jack,
the fact is, look at the record of the last 10 years and what the job creation with all these tax cuts.
Oh, yeah, I want to shift to China and Japan, but this has been part of at least a three-decade process of transferring wealth from the majority of people in the country to the rich.
Yeah, they call it a jobs bill.
They use all the Orwellian language to hide what they're really doing.
We just passed a bill to give $30 billion to the smaller banks, and we called it the jobs bill.
A jobs bill. Talk about China and Japan and the time
we
have left.
We should say something about that because it's another interesting indication, very recent developments here. Okay, what did Japan do? Japan officially recently just devalued their currency. Why? Because Japan's slipping back into a recession. And they got a political upheaval going on. They're changing all kind of political parties and so forth over there. And they're very concerned. And Japan relies heavily on export sales for its economy. So, you know, they lowered their currency value in order to expand their exports. What's been going on between China, Japan, U.S., and Europe and so far in this crisis, it's been what I call internal devaluations. In other words, they increase the competitiveness of their products and trying to steal each other's exports by reducing their costs at home, which means reducing labor costs. But that can only go so far. And what we see now that's significant is the emergence, in this case of Japan, with the beginning of kinds of what I call external devaluations, in other words, official devaluations, which is what you see when a crisis gets much worse. Now, why is Japan and China going at it? Well, Japan's trying to lower its the value of its currency, and China jumps in and starts buying Japan currency, Japan bonds in record amounts, which drives Japan's currency up. So Japan is being undermined by China. In other words, Japan's economic policy. China is keeping Japan fairly weak, which, by the way, forces the United States to come in and help Japan, because Japan is a kind of economic appendage of the U.S. economy since the 1980s, right? And that's why one of the reasons why Fed is talking about a QE2. In other words, we got to lower the value of the U.S. dollar even more in order to raise the value of or to help Japan. Okay, in the long run. I won't go through the whole process here of how that works. And at the same time, the U.S. is attacking China to raise the value of its currency instead of the U.S. devaluing its own currency, because the U.S. knows it's going to engage in QE2 here, which will devalue the U.S. currency. So you got this three-way interaction between U.S., China, and Japan on the currency front that's very indicative of everybody trying, all three of them trying to rob Peter to pay Paul. And, of course, Europeans are now about to enter the fray, too, as their economy slows. There's a special Euro Currency Emergency Committee that's going to come out very soon with a position on all this. So all the big capitalist blocks are beginning to figure out how do they grow at the expense of each other. And that's significant, I think.
What will that do if they're all vying with each other? What will the effect of that be? I mean, that sounds very negative to me.
Well, what it represents is that they've got domestic slowdowns going on in all their economies, and they're trying to counter the domestic slowdowns by stimulating export sales. okay? And you do that at the expense of your export partners when there's a crisis, and that's what this represents. Okay, they're trying to coordinate and cooperate with each other, but they're being forced by the extended decline and stagnation to start nipping at each other. And that reflects a further deterioration of the situation.
What about any growing protectionism?
Well, I don't think that's how it's going to occur. You know, protectionism means raise tariffs and prevent foreign direct investment and stuff like that. That's the way it occurred in the 30s, but that's not the way it's going to occur now. It's going to occur with this pressures, political pressures on each other to raise or lower the value of their currencies, and or it's going to occur by reducing costs and improving the competitiveness of your exports by attacking wages and benefits and so forth. It's taking a new form, a different form. It's increasing competition between them as they get squeezed with the recovery, but it's not taking the same overt form that it did in the 1930s. It's taking a more covert form, you might say, here of pressure on each other to raise the value of their currencies or to drive the value of the currency up, like the Chinese driving the value of the Japan's yen currency up while Japan's trying to lower the yen. In the U.S., of course, going after China, and the U.S. going to have to do something to help Japan. Very interesting, last week, the latest Japanese party in power and so forth has really turned to the United States and said, help us out here with this China thing.
Jack, I guess as we get into 2011, especially with a Republican Congress, at least in one house, the situation that is really grim for so many people now will get grimmer. And if you can look ahead a year from now, my goodness, I suspect that we will be worse off, maybe a lot worse off than we are now for most people. I don't know about the banks. I don't know about the rich people. They may do fine. But for ordinary people in this country, we'll still see a terrible job situation. We have literally a housing depression. I don't think you disagree on that.
And, no, not at all. So we're at 25% of housing production.
And it took many years for the bubble to peak and burst, and I guess without question it will take many years for the healing to happen. So we see just a terrible situation going on.
Well, you know, because Congress and fiscal policy will be counter effective, actually causing things to get worse. What you're going to see is more reliance on the Fed. The Fed's just waiting until after the November election. The Fed's very concerned, as I said before, because we have disinflation, which means we're heading towards zero price increases and deflation and all those problems. So when the Fed engages in QE2 and pumps $1 trillion more into the economy, that's going to drive the U.S. dollar even lower. It's going to raise the prices of imports. So people who rely on cheap imports, consumers who are on the edge of the cliff are going to have to pay more. That's going to reduce their income. It's going to be more commodities inflation, food, energy, and the necessities are going to raise in price. And I believe what we're headed for in 2012-13 is a bond bust. Both treasury bonds and junk bonds, corporate junk bonds, I think we're running a real risk of a big bust in 2012-2013.
We're out of time, Jack. But when you say a bust, you mean these, especially on treasuries, these low interest rates are unsustainable. At some point, they're going to go up, and that will only cause more trouble.
Well, watch the junk bonds. That's even more serious than treasury bonds.
Oh, boy. One problem after another. Jack,
yeah.
We're out of time. Another great program. Again, I say it every time you're on or discuss the economy. What's going on now is not going away. And as time passes, it looks like things are getting worse. This is what the Obama folks in the Congress are doing for us. And if you think the Democrats were giving us a raw deal, just wait till the Republicans come in, as you explained, Jack. Many, many thanks. I look forward to another round next month.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Jack. And join us again tomorrow, same time. Another. program, important topic. Oh, I got a moment. Let me just tell you who my guest is. My goodness, so much going on. Oh, we will be back on, we'll be talking about, on with Stephen Zellinga. And Stephen Zellinga runs the American Monetary Institute. He's got a big conference coming up in Chicago, by the way. And he's got a lot of interesting ideas. He was on some months back. He'll be back on. And he'll be telling you his views on what's wrong with the way the economy and our monetary policy is being run. And he's a very knowledgeable guy. He's written a lot of books. Join us tomorrow.